Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of the Jane Austen podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there, everybody. Oh, wow. It's Kristen saying, hey there, everybody. How bizarre. How bizarre. Where is Jenny Owen Youngs, you might ask? Well, for this intro, you've just got me, trusty Kristen, because Jenny is today driving across the United States of America, headed to move to the Northeast. So you will have two hosts in the same time zone very, very soon, before Halloween, as a matter of fact. I'm here today, speaking of Halloween, to introduce you into an interview that Jenny and I did with Juliette Landau. That's right, Drusilla herself. We have literally the best conversation with Juliette. She is a delight. She talks to us, of course, all about her time on Buffy and on Angel, and about her movie release, which is happening in just a few days on October 29th. Juliette's film is called A Place Among the Dead, and you can go to the premiere of the movie online on October 29th. All of the information is found at modernfilms.com/A Place Among the Dead. Modern Films, by the way, an all-women run production company. So that's pretty freaking cool as well. So there's a premiere on the 29th of A Place Among the Dead. It's a really, really powerful film, and Juliette and her husband Dev put so much work into it. It features appearances by people you may have heard of, like Joss Whedon, Anne Rice, Gary Oldman, and so many others, and you'll hear us talk about it in the interview that you're about to listen to. A couple of quick things before we go into talking to Juliette. A slight delay on our next episode, Season 6, Episode 3, Afterlife. That was set to air on November 4th. We are holding it until November 9th, which is just the following Monday. So just a few more days, you'll have to wait for that episode. That's the next time that you'll hear from us in this feed. And this Wednesday, of course, you're going to get Season 3, Episode 2 of Angel on Top. That Vision thing, pretty Cordelia heavy, and you may or may not get a little segment from me talking about Lila playing golf. But listen, that's neither here nor there. Also, our live taping was unexpectedly rescheduled. So heads up, if November 22nd is a good day for you, that's a Sunday, you can come on over and see our live taping then. We will be taping Season 6, Episode 5, Life Serial. All of the information forever and ever will be found at bufferingthevampireslayer.com. Again, to learn how to grab tickets to Juliette's premiere event for A Place Among the Dead, go to modernfilms.com/A Place Among the Dead. I am going to stop talking so that you can hear Juliette tell us all about things like press-on nails, role-playing as Spike, and why Julie Benz always knew that, of course, there was romance between Drew and Darla. Let's get the hell into this episode. My gosh.
Wow. We are so excited. So very, very excited to be here today speaking with the one and the only Juliette Landau. Juliette, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Absolutely. I'm super excited to be here.
Ah, we're so excited to have you here. I feel like we've been waiting for this moment since, I don't even know, when we first met you years ago at this point.
I know. We've been wanting to do this forever, and when it's finally here,
Yes. And the timing is quite wonderful for a lot of reasons. One, it's Halloween, or near to it. and two, you have a movie coming out right now.
Yep. In Halloween, it's actually, we're having the worldwide premiere October 29th. It's being sponsored by MAC Cosmetics and also by New York Comic Con, then preview screening events, Halloween weekend, and then the wide release. So super excited.
Oh my gosh. Do you have costume? Are you dressing up for Halloween in a movie themed kind of way?
It's funny because we were talking about that. We're going to be doing this incredible event with Tomorrow's Ghosts and screening the movie and doing the Q&A and then having all kinds of other panels. And I think I will be changing at one point in the schedule of events. And I've dragged Dev, my husband, into it as well. So I think we're going to dress up. What about you guys?
Yes, we are. We actually, we take Halloween very seriously now that we have a Buffy the Vampire Slayer podcast. We're in season 6 now. And so there is an episode.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thanks. but we are, for the podcast, we are dressing up, I believe, this year as 2 employees of the Double Meat Palace, which is the fast food restaurant that
yes,
Buffy works at.
Perfect.
So, Julia, we have obviously, you know, we could stay on with you for about 4 years and not run out of things to talk about. But we want to make sure that we get to talk to you both about your time on Buffy the Vampire Slayer as Drusilla and also the movie that you made. And I would imagine that there's probably even overlap between those 2 things. So
great.
How about we start at the very beginning, at least the very beginning as it pertains to Buffy? We would love to hear how you came to the show. Like, what's your origin story, Juliet as Drusilla?
Well, it was interesting. I actually didn't audition for the role. I had a creative meeting, and it was with Joss, David Greenwalt, Gail Berman, and Marcia Shulman, who was the head of casting at Fox. And it was the most fun meeting. It was just incredible. We bounced ideas back and forth. Joss said that he thought that the character could be British or American. And I was saying, oh, I really think she should be British. And he said, yes, if we can find a Spike that can do that or is English. And I did a little bit of Drew in the room. I think I started talking to the ceiling at one point. Really, really great. And literally before I got to my car, I was walking to my car and hadn't even made it from the room that we had been meeting in. And my phone rang and my agent called and said, they want to hire you. And I said, well, I haven't left yet. And they said, yeah, no, they did. They loved you. They thought it was great. And so it was amazing and such a creative experience right from the get-go. It's funny because sometimes you'll audition for something, you know, 12 times and not get it, or 20 times mm-hmm. and you do get it. But it was one of those things. And I had a similar thing with Tim Burton on Ed Wood, where it just felt like it was meant to be and sort of happened very easily.
I feel like some of that, like, it makes so much sense too. So many of our listeners wrote in asking, you know, what did Juliet bring? Like, did Juliet have creative input on Drusilla as a character? And can you talk about that? And so many of the actors from the show who we have spoken with did not really get to have a lot of creative input. And it sounds like you did. It sounds like you really were in the room sort of helping to create this character.
It was an incredibly collaborative experience. As far as the text and the writing, that was completely Joss and the team of brilliant writers. So all of the script was them. And then it was collaborative beyond that in terms of Drew's mannerisms and the way she moved and her vocal quality and all of those aspects. And even, you know, James and I both come from a theater background. So we, at least season 2, we would get the scripts about a week in advance. And so we would get together and rehearse on our own. And we would come in with a lot of ideas for the blocking of the scenes, which is basically where you're moving in the scenes. And most of the time they loved it and said, that's great. And it saved a lot of time for everyone. And we would be up and running. So it was really a joy. And even with things that you would do and you think, oh, well, maybe it got cut out of an episode. So maybe it wasn't, you know, Joss didn't like it or something. It would end up finding its way into scripts later, which was really exciting.
That's amazing. Wow,
it makes sense too, because she has like this very rich interior world that's sort of like overlaid You know, over the actual world, she's kind of like existing in multiple realms at once. So it just feels like there's so much more build that has to happen there for you.
Absolutely. And it was interesting because when I was first cast, I was cast and then they paired me with the final choices for Spike. And I had an incredibly wonderful meeting with Joss right at the beginning where he told me all of the vampire lore and the history. And he said that he had had Spike and Drew running around in his mind for 10 years prior to that. So they would definitely had like a rich history that he communicated to me.
Oh, wow.
We obviously, I know that we both want to talk to you more about your movement and the voice, but we are like in James territory, in Spike territory now. So in keeping with the flow of the conversation, can we go and talk about your chemistry with James and you know, how that played out? I mean, I know, you know, you're both actors, you're very incredible actors, but the chemistry is really palpable. And so I'm wondering if you can tell us about finding your Spike, you know, finding James and also like your work together.
Ah, thank you. You know, from the moment he came in to his audition, it was interesting. A lot of the other actors came in and they were wonderful actors, but we just had an immediate acting chemistry, and all kinds of things happened in his audition that ended up making it into our first episode, the School Heart episode. Mm-hmm. It really was one of those things that they call moment to moment acting, where stuff just sort of surprises you and happens. So for instance, one of the scenes for his audition was with the Anointed One. And we had that moment where we were sort of looking at each other and our heads rested like we might kiss. And at a moment we said almost like, oh yeah, we're talking to someone else, the Anointed One. And we turned out and it was very cool. And that not only did it make it into the episode, but it ended up being a whole promo thing that the network used. They used us, our heads resting, our heads turning out. And then a voiceover that said, "Evil has a few new faces." It was nice.
Gosh, I could like hear the WB voice, you know.
Yeah.
So let's before, because I have, you know, a lot of questions for you about vampires and how they love and if they can love. But before we get too carried away, because it's so easy to get swept into all that is Spike and Drew, let me take us back to your movement and your voice. Those are two things that obviously are just massive parts of Drusilla. We have a host of our Angel podcast, Angel on Top, Latoya Ferguson, and she texted us like, please, please, please ask Juliet how she came to the accent. Like, what was that process? So maybe let's start there.
Okay. That's a great question, Latoya. I definitely based it on someone specific. But the cadence and the sort of sing-song, wafty quality came really from the character choices. And so it was a combination of a person that I know from a specific region and then got informed by Drew's own sort of personality so that it ended up sounding the way that it did with those two elements blended together.
And you have a background in dance, in ballet. That's correct, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know, I found it such a useful thing, and definitely came into play with Drusilla and the way that she sort of wafted and glided through space and moved was definitely, you know, that ended up being a big component of her.
Yeah, and like, what a great synthesis too of like the meeting of the accent and like the way that you speak in the role and stuff, and then the sort of fluidity of movement. It's just like combining to make this like perfect, fully formed, super, super memorable character. Just like, brava.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Thank you.
It's true. It's sort of like Drusilla just never stops moving. Like, she's just the most fluid vampire. And, you know, is such a, as you know, better than anyone, is just such an iconic vampire in the Buffyverse. But I think overall that Drusilla is an iconic contemporary vampire. And I wonder if you have thoughts on that. Like, what is it to occupy a character like Drusilla and to feel that, like, adoration and, you know, have people idolize the character? Is that something that resonates with you?
Well, it's amazing in terms of the response is incredible. I mean, when you're working on it, you know, you're sort of inside inhabiting the character and you're trying to make it, you know, even if you're working on a supernatural character, you're trying to make flesh out and make as human as possible, as relatable as possible. It's just like the same thing with playing a villain, you know, a person who's does evil things doesn't necessarily think of themselves as evil. So you get into the viewpoint of where they're coming from. And obviously from the outside, that looks very different than their own rationalizations. So it's incredible because you're in this bubble of creativity, and then to have people see what you're doing, echo the work that you're doing back to you in terms of how they're describing the character and what they're feeling from it, is wonderful and really a kind of bonus from the experience that you're having being on the inside of it.
Absolutely. And you talked about, you know, coming in School Heart. That's your first episode as Drusilla. It's the first time we meet Drusilla. And having talked to, you know, various people from the show, we imagine you didn't know how long you were going to be Drusilla, how long Drusilla was going to be in the universe. And so I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about the finding out of the extension of that character's run and how many times she was going to reappear, and also maybe learning more about her backstory as you went along. I don't know if you knew everything about Drew that there was to know when you began.
Well, it was interesting because I did know. It's funny, James, I guess, didn't know as much as I knew, which I didn't know until later. it turns out I did know that we were going to be running throughout season two, and then the characters were so popular that we and Joss was creatively excited about the directions that the characters were going. And so we were kept on longer and longer. I knew a lot of the backstory because of that meeting with Joss, where he told me what had been the machinations that had been in his brain. But then along the way, there were certain things like the threesome with the immortal on Angel. I had no idea. I mean, it was really... I got the script. I remember calling Julie Benz and saying, like, I had no idea we did this. And she said, oh, I knew. I always knew something like that. And then she actually cited, there's a still picture of us from the episode, I think it's the reunion episode, where the whole car scene, and I'm sort of hugging Julie, and she circled it and sent it to me. And my hand is actually, one hand is holding her and hugging her, and the other hand is actually sort of cradling her butt. And she went, see, I always knew this was happening. There were some surprises along the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, vampires, we talk about vampires in our podcast universe as fairly sexually fluid beings, but I would love to hear, you know, your take on that. You've been positioned sort of, you know, maybe very pointedly in a throuple, but we just extrapolate and imagine that Angel, Spike, and Drusilla were also a throuple at some point. So I wonder what your take is. You can correct me if I'm wrong, by the way, about that throuple, but
I think you're right. I think there was all kind of triangles going on there.
Right. And do you think that vampires are just inherently sexually fluid beings?
Well, I mean, I think it sort of depends on the universe, but I think often, and I think, you know, you're also dealing with characters that have been alive for centuries and centuries and experience and, you know, may fall in love across gender lines. And so it definitely seems like that happens in a lot of the vampire lore and makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, especially with the connection between like feeding, you know, like feeding is especially in the Buffyverse, but I think in a lot of lore, a lot of vampire lore, the feeding is made to seem sexual in nature. Yeah.
I mean, that's even, you know, initially with it, where the vampire lore came from, and you look at Bram Stoker and you look at all of that was sort of during time when you couldn't explicitly talk about sex. It was a way to mm-hmm. have a sort of sexual act, penetration, mm-hmm. connection, all of that in this other way of dealing with it.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of love before penetration, from just before, do you, from your perspective, do you feel like Drusilla was in love with Spike? And broader question, do you think vampires are capable of love within the universe?
Well, yes, absolutely. In terms of Drew and Spike, I think they had an epic love affair, and I think it was monumental. I mean, how many people can say that they've been in a relationship for, 200 years? sustained all of that. And I think there was the thing that was lovely about it is, you know, clearly they had a sexual connection, but they also had a really sweet, loving side as well, which I think was evident between them. And he often was taking care of Drew when she would have the freakouts and all that kind of stuff. And they really seemed to, you know, adore one another. It's funny because my husband Dev and I, we ended up at one point watching all of Buffy and Angel again sequentially through, because when I first had watched, I had watched it all, but because of some of the way that the episodes and when I was doing episodes, I didn't watch everything in its order. I had watched everything, but not all together in that way. And there was a moment where we were on the couch, and it was part of the storyline when Spike is going for Buffy, and I said, "Oh, I can't believe it." I mean, I was still sort of in the Drew mindset, like 200 years. Why is he going with that cheerleader? And Dev looked up at me and he was like, "Juliet." So I don't think you can inhabit a character for so long and sort of not still have that, you know? Yeah. I definitely think that there was a deep love there.
It's interesting too. We talk at this point in our conversation too, we've been talking a lot about Spike and Angel, and or well, not Spike and Angel, I should say Spike and Angelus, and like their distinct differences as vampires. And one of them is our belief, you know, that Spike is capable of love in a way that Angelus wasn't. And since you had, you know, relationships, Drusilla had relationships with both of those vampires, I would love to hear your thoughts on sort of the difference between the Angelus vampire and that love or lust or neither, and Spike.
Well, I think the Angelus love was a very complex and complicated. It was really incestuous because he was a father figure and a lover, and there was a lot of damage there. The way that the relationship was forged was in violence and madness, and so I think if you're going to characterize one vampire love story as healthier than the other, you know, considering they're people, like, you know, they're beings that go out and feed on people and things like that, I would say that the Spike relationship was a healthier give and take, and a support of one another and helping each other's needs. And the Angelus Drusilla was a more damaged and dark connection, mm-hmm. and unhealthy, really.
Yeah, we had a question from a listener named Sandy, who is a trauma therapist, and was curious to know what it was like for you playing a vampire with trauma. And Sandy also said that you did an amazing job depicting that trauma bond with Angelus and the support, the need for support from Spike to kind of like balance that out.
Oh. Well, thank you so much, Sandy. That's amazing to hear. I did a lot of research. I actually went to the Thalens Institute, which is part of Cedars-Sinai, and talked to a specialist in schizophrenia and all kinds of stuff that I did in terms of researching the real elements of that. And I think, Sandy, that you will really respond to A Place Among the Dead because it's all about how trauma affects one's choices going forward. So I think that that's going to be something that will really speak to you in the work that you do.
Before we get to A Place Among the Dead, there's a couple of other questions. Some of them are fun. You know, if you have perhaps, like, do you have a favorite scene from either series? You know, you span, Drusilla spans the arc of Buffy and Angel. So is there a favorite scene that you have, a memory that you have of filming something that just really sticks out from the pack?
In terms of, I would say I have three favorite episodes, not necessarily scenes, but the first episode, School Hard, because it was our introductory episode and it was the first time working together and working on the set, and it was just such a wonderful experience. I would say Surprise, because it's where Drusilla gets strong and in her full powers. Mm. And then Reunion on Angel, because it was pretty amazing to get to wreak havoc and team up with Julie's character in Los Angeles and do all kinds of fun stuff like eating the lawyers and all of that.
Getting set on fire, eating the lawyers. So much excitement.
Although, the funny thing about the fire thing, if you're wanting a behind-the-scenes story, so we were shooting the sequence where Drew has already been burned, and it's the whole fire hydrant where the water comes spraying. And we were shooting that downtown. It was one of the, LA doesn't usually get cold, but it was a very rare, crazy cold night. We were shooting nights, of course, with vampires. And so I think it was about, I don't know, 5 a.m. or something, and it was freezing. We were in parkas in between the takes. We, of course, had to take them off. And Julie had a 104 fever. She was sick. And I was boasting, like, I never get sick when I work. And of course, I got sick. And so we were sick. It was freezing. And we then had that thing where the water was supposed to come. And they said, oh, well, we're not going to rehearse it because we basically want, you know, we're going to have to change you when you're wet and go into other clothes to pick up the shot again. And so they yell action, and they sort of showed us a test of the water, which was like a small amount coming. And then they said, okay. And I'm crying through the scene. I forget the dialogue, but I'm saying all this stuff and I'm crying. I've got tears, and they're like, okay, and action. And for whatever reason, they boosted the water. So it was like a torrent. I mean, just pounds and pounds and pounds. And I'm trying to sit up straight with the torrent of water while weeping. And I'm so, you know, I have the dancer back. I'm like, don't ruin the take, get through the take. So I'm going through the whole take and going, oh, and crying and trying to just, and it's water. And then we end the scene, they yell cut, and everyone just burst out laughing because it was the most hysterical thing to be like trying to continue with it. They're like, okay, sorry about that. We need to lower the water.
So, oh my gosh. The things you don't know. No, we love behind the scenes stories. Of course. Knowing what's going on in the background is maybe one of the biggest joys of what we do. Finding out the secrets.
I can tell you another one that you guys might enjoy. When killing Kendra, we had the sequence of Drew in the confessional back in the 1800s scheduled to shoot right before the killing Kendra scene. And the nails, the Drusilla manicure, was evident in the killing Kendra, since I'm slicing her throat with my nails. And obviously the character cannot have that manicure back in 1853. So Todd McIntosh said, okay, there's no time with the schedule. We'll do the sort of, you know, press on nails for you. And that way they can be featured in the scene and we won't hold production up with having nail polish dry and all of that. So we go through, we shoot the confessional scene. We come in, we've got the press on nails. I've got the 5-inch heels that I'm in. Bianca and I have worked out with the stunt coordinator, all of the fight choreography. Everything's going, for whatever reason, she was supposed to kick me like I'm holding my hands at a certain place and it's like mid-stomach kind of area. The minute they yell action, for some reason, she is getting, oh, well, even before this, let me go before this. Before this, we're doing the part of the fight before the kick. And every time we're doing it, my nails are literally going, bing, 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 like completely flying off. And everybody's freaking out. Oh no, back to one. We have to fix this. How do we get the nails? And we're going again. I'm trying to keep my nails on. It's like, it's almost like a joke because I'm holding my nails out and being like, okay, how do I do this with keeping these nails on? We go back and we're doing it. And then again, bing, 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 they're flying. Then we get to the kick part. And for whatever reason, I guess in the moment of action, Bianca got excited, whatever happened, I see her boot, instead of it coming to my mid-torso where it's coming, I'm like, oh no, it's coming toward my head. Oh, no. You know how things go in slow. And I see her huge combat boot, and she clunks me so hard in the head. And I'm such a girly girl, like I've never been in a fight or anything like that. And so all of a sudden, I see those little speckles, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, you really do stars. And again, I'm thinking, okay, I'm not going to ruin the take, so I'm going to keep going. It made this huge sound, and I'm thinking again to myself, I wonder if everybody heard that or if it's just loud because of my head. And I grab her by the neck, and I kind of looked in her eyes very much like, do not do that again. Like, we have to focus here, right? And I back her into the wall. And it's actually the take that's used because of the intensity of how I'm like, do not kick me in. And I actually had a concussion. They had to drive me home that night and everything. But they got the take. It looked great. And it worked out well. And luckily in that one, the nails weren't flying off. So.
Oh my gosh. Little did Kendra know that all she had to do was flick one of your stick-on nails off and she could have.
Right. She would have escaped. Right. Lived. Exactly. She would have lived.
Well, that is a perfect, perfect segue to a question from our listener, Havana. And really, I have this question too. We're just dying to know, you know, Drusilla has iconic manicures. But there's two specifically. There's black with white tips and red with white tips. So which one do you like more? What is your favorite of those two manicures for Drusilla?
Well, you know what's interesting? There's actually one episode where there's a third manicure, which is blue. Ooh. With white tips in the episode of the Chaos Demon. Nice. Where he's all slimy behind. Yes. James.
Bless his soul.
In that episode, Drew actually has blue with white tips. But, you know, I really loved both of those manicures. It was interesting because the black with white tips is when Drew is weak and dying and not doing well. And then the red comes in when she regains her strength. There was, you know, that's one of the things that was so great about working on Buffy is, you know, all those little details feed the actual character arc as well. So I guess I would say potentially the red with white tips, since it's strong Drew, although I like the black with white tips and I enjoyed the initial Drew too. So it's hard for me to pick. What do you guys think?
I'm partial to the, I mean, it's very hard to choose, but I'm partial to the red, and I didn't even realize why, but perhaps it is because it's a symbol of Drew's strength. But I just love the red.
Have you ever worn it?
No, I have not done the Drew manicure yet. There's no way that I will make it till the end of this podcast without having at least one Drew manicure.
Next Halloween. This is an oddball. This is like a wild question to contemplate from the outside anyway, because, you know, you so fully and completely embody the character of Drusilla. But we were wondering if you had to play a different character within the Buffy or Angelverse, if there was a character that you felt drawn to or interested in exploring.
You know, I wouldn't trade Drew just because I found her so delicious to play. And, you know, it's rare also, especially on television, to have such a complex and dimensional character. But I guess if I had to pick another one, I would probably go for Buffy. I mean, the show is called Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So the actress in me would like that, you know? So I think I'd go with Buffy.
It's true. I don't know that there's like any character really like juicier than Drew. Like, there's just so much happening in Drusilla that it makes sense that you wouldn't want to trade her for anybody else.
Yeah. It was fun. She literally almost had sort of Shakespearean qualities, and you don't get that unless you're doing Shakespeare. And so, there's an element of Ophelia, or, it was pretty great.
Yeah. Drusilla's lines are so iconic. There's so many of them that I know that we would love to ask you about, but a listener did write in and I had the same question wondering, there's a scene, I don't remember the episode. It's at the very beginning of Drew. She's looking up at the ceiling in the warehouse and she says,
I'm naming all the stars.
You can't see the stars, love. That's the ceiling. Also, it's day.
I can see them, but I've named them all the same name, and there's terrible confusion.
I'm sure that you've been asked this question before, but do you know what Drusilla named all of the stars?
I'm trying to remember. I have my scripts and notes, and I'm sure I had something, but I think it was something like Genevieve.
Nice.
I just named them all Genevieve. And
I love it.
It got a bit confusing.
Yeah. Did you, Julia, did you get to keep anything from a set from either of the shows? You had, obviously, Drusilla is known for her dolls and Miss Edith especially. But I wonder if you got to keep any clothing or the dolls or anything like that.
Funny, I was offered all this stuff. I'm not a collector person, so I didn't take it, which Dev is always saying, why didn't you take it? I do have a few things. There were a set of vampire teeth that I had been given to work with at home just because they're hard to work with. So I actually have those, and I have the 100 episode, they actually gave us a stake that they engraved a wood stake. And so I have that. And I didn't keep Miss Edith. What was interesting with Miss Edith is that they had her scripted on, the earlier episodes. And then later on some of the episodes that she reappeared, I actually had asked for her because she wasn't in the script. And I know on one of the episodes, and they actually didn't have Miss Edith anymore, so they had to recreate Miss Edith, which they did perfectly because she looked identical. And then I had my dolly back to stab her eyes out and do all my various activities and stuff. But I actually have a funny story also about the vampire teeth. So when I was home working on them and talking and doing dialogue at the time of the show, and it was 2 a.m. and I thought, oh, okay, I'm gonna take the garbage out and nobody's gonna be around. It doesn't matter. I don't have to take the teeth out. What's gonna happen? And so I went out to the garbage and I'm literally putting the thing in the bin and I hear this, hi. Oh my gosh, I'm your new neighbor. I just wanted to come and say hi. And I was completely panicked because I thought, oh my God, I'm going to scare this woman to death if I start talking and open my mouth. And so I literally put my hand up to my mouth and said, it's really nice to meet you. And I ran up to the house. And then I later told her, and she thought it was quite funny, but she said, thank you so much. I would have actually had a heart attack if in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. I met you and you've had your teeth.
Oh my gosh. Lovely to meet the new neighbors. They only come out at night.
Exactly.
We have what I think is a fun question from our listener, Fred, who wanted to know if Drusilla, we have vampires with souls, with chips. We got vampires with all sorts of things in these universes. But Drusilla, if Drusilla was given a soul akin to our Angelus angel, do you think that there would be somebody in particular from the Buffyverse or the Angelverse who she would be drawn to, who she would most want to be friends with?
Yeah, I think as a friend, probably Xander. I think Xander and Drew. I mean, we did have that Halloween episode. I know everybody was going after Xander in that episode, but that Drew and Xander would he could make his quick quips and she could make her slow non sequiturs, and it would be a really weird, great conversation.
Oh my God. Somebody give that to us, please. If you're a writer and you hear this, please give us a little Drew plus Xander being best friends chat. Did you, Julia, and maybe this is a question that will span past your work on Buffy, but did you stay in character? Was Drusilla a character that you needed to stay in, or did you just kind of snap in and out of it as the takes were going?
Definitely did not stay in character. I think that would be pretty wild and scare everybody in the crew. I did often, actually unintentionally to some degree, James and I would find that we would stay in our dialects and in our accents and just stay kind of speaking that way, almost unbeknownst to ourselves. I remember Brian Thompson, who plays the big blue guy in the surprise episode, was saying when we saw him, I think somewhere a month or two later from our shoot date, was really surprised at how we spoke. I said, "Oh my God, wait, this is weird. I talked to you like 16 hours a day for, you know, the whole shoot and had no idea."
Today's episode is brought to you by Regal Cinemas. If you're anything like me, you deeply enjoy going to the movies. Going to the movies is probably among my top three all-time activities. I love seeing films on the big screen. I also love being around other people who are watching the same movie with me at the same time. And of course, I love eating giant buckets of popcorn. If you feel the same and you like going to the theater, Regal Unlimited is something that just makes sense. Regal Unlimited is the all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass. It pays for itself in two movie visits. You can see any standard 2D movie anytime, no blackout dates, no restrictions. When you want to watch a movie in 4DX or IMAX or RPX or ScreenX, there's so many ways to watch movies these days, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost. And with Regal Unlimited, you don't only save money on the tickets, you will also save on your snacks. And as previously mentioned, I love snacks. The only thing that can make me love a snack more is saving money on buying a snack. Members get 10% off of all non-alcoholic concession items with membership. Regal Unlimited, all you can watch movie subscription pass. It pays for itself in two visits. So if you're planning to see two movies this month, join Regal Unlimited and sign up now. You can sign up in the Regal app or on regmovies.com/unlimited. Sign up for Regal Unlimited using code BUFFERING and earn 10% off your 3-month subscription. Please let us know about all of the movies you see and how the popcorn is.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
So Jenny does not like when we get to this part of the interview where we say Jenny wrote a jingle for Drusilla's character. She likes to hide under the desk away from the attention, but we don't know if you got a chance to hear it. I would love to know what your thoughts are on the Drusilla jingle in the Buffering the Vampire Slayer universe.
Oh, God.
I love it so much. It's fantastic. Yeah. It is really, really phenomenal.
Thank you so much. We really love to honor characters that really, really resonate with us so that every time they do something we really love while we're talking about it within the episode, we can just trigger a jingle to be like, yes, Drusilla.
Drusilla, you fill my heart with dread, and still I'm led right back to you.
It's perfect. It's perfect. perfect for Drew.
Yeah, Drew. Somebody wrote it and said, Jenny, that they think Drusilla's jingle is the most on,
wow,
like the most spot on for the character. Yeah.
Yeah, you definitely nailed it, for sure.
Thank you so much.
You put the nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
Our listener Annie wrote in to ask if you think that your character was a potential slayer before being sired, given that she was having prophetic visions, which is a precursor to being chosen a lot of the time.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't have that viewpoint when I was playing it, but I think that it could make a lot of sense. What do you guys think about that?
I think we both had a similar experience with the question. We had not thought of it either, but as soon as I read it, I was like, whoa. I'm actually, the comment came through on Instagram, and you know, you can like people's comments, and the comment of that question had like upwards of 30 people
being
just like,
wow,
yes, oh my God, I never thought of this. Holy
yeah.
shit.
And he also said perhaps that's why Angel and Spike were both kind of like drawn to Drusilla in the first place, which makes a lot of sense too.
Yeah, it all would make sense. Now I need to check that with Joss.
Right? He'll probably have the same response as all of us. Like, I didn't think of it, but yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Sometimes the story writes itself, you know?
That's very true.
Juliet, before we move to talking about your movie, something that I would really love to hear about from you is your interaction with the Buffy fandom. You know, I think so many people from the show have done so many cons and interact and are just wonderful with the fandom overall and have such a great relationship. But I feel that yours is really so powerful. You know, we see you interacting with people one-on-one. You're just so engaged. And I just would love to hear about that experience for you and maybe how it's changed over time too.
Well, the Buffy fans are the best. I mean, seriously, the best. Everybody's so smart and interesting and fun. And the other thing that's awesome is how everybody follows you from project to project. Once they like your work from Buffy, they are there for you. And the conversations that you get to have, are really fascinating. I mean, it's just, you couldn't have a better group of people. And I've been really touched by how many people I've met and how many people have said that Buffy's gotten them through really hard times or been really influential or instrumental in their lives. I have a dear friend, someone who's become a really dear friend, who became a therapist because of Buffy and because of the character of Drusilla intrigued her. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that you hope to have an impact when you're doing work that, you know, I've been able to see and have people talk to me about that is just incredibly powerful.
And I think, I don't know, it does seem the more we talk to people who are involved in the making of the show that it is a product of like this symbiosis that happens, because everyone who we've spoken to from the show also has this wonderful, open, kind nature. And it just sort of seems like it has its own energy.
Yeah.
Well, the show wouldn't have been what it was without the community. And it is like we're all connected in that. And so, you know, as an artist, you do stuff that you hope speaks to people. And if you have that and you get to interact, it's just really amazing.
Thank you for giving us Drusilla.
Yeah.
I truly, I can't. I mean, I think, yeah, Drusilla changed the landscape, really changed the game for the vamps out there.
Very cool. I like to say sometimes that it was obscenely fun to play Drew, because it was going to work every day. You know, it was incredibly creative, and all of the people were so wonderful. And, you know, it's not a bad day's work when you're kissing James and kissing David. Like, oh my God, my job is just so, so hard.
Yeah. Did you ever get like injured from those cheekbones of James's, you know? Did they ever?
It's funny you say that, because we actually did a thing once at Read and Con where they had us do a sort of improv where I was Spike and he was
oh
Drew.
Oh my God.
And what was funny is I took it. So James is totally, he's in the green room and he's totally laid back and just like, oh yeah, I'm going to wing it. And I was Googling and looking up clips of Spike, because obviously I'd always been inside the scenes from Drew's perspective. So I'm like, let me look at Spike and so I can nail his mannerisms. And so I was doing the Spike walk and I was doing his, like everything, the way he stands. And I was doing, I kept sort of referring to my cheekbones and making like tucking in my cheeks and doing his accent and saying the cheekbones. And it was just really like, it was very fun. Everybody was laughing and James was like mirroring me with his cheekbones.
Oh my God.
And so.
Oh my God. Is there footage of this anywhere?
I would
pay good money to see this role reversal improv. Holy shit.
I don't think so. It was funny too, because at one point we actually sat down on, there was a couch, and then we realized there was a window there and we were like, ah, so it was sunlight. So it was just, it was actually a fun and fluid experience, but I don't think any film of it. But he was, he kept trying. He was like, I don't think I captured Drew as well. And I was like, well, you weren't studying in the green room.
Yeah, he should know by now. He's worked with you long enough to know that he's got to do his research to step up.
Well, it's funny you said that, because when we were doing an interview for TV Guide, and it was James, myself, and David, and they were asking about me on set, and David said, oh, you know, she brings, because I sometimes bring, at that point, it was not an iPod yet. It was a Walkman, right? Yeah. And so I brought my music and would sometimes, you know, because I like to create a soundtrack for each character. And so he started sort of moving around. You guys can't see me, but sort of moving around in a Drew-like way, saying to the reporter, this is Juliet on set. Can we run lines? Can we rehearse? Can we run lines? Can we rehearse? Can we run lines? Can we rehearse? 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 And so they printed that.
Is the existence of Drusilla's playlist, is that public, on public record? Is that something that we can find somewhere?
No, I always, it's interesting. I do it for every character, and it's when I'm working on a character, I put music together. When I was just on Bosch playing Rita Tedesco, I had her soundtrack. Right now I'm actually going back to do a recurring role on Claws, which I started just before quarantine, and we're now picking back up again. And so every character has a separate soundtrack, and Drew's, you know, I know what it is, but it hasn't been published anywhere.
I love it.
You gotta keep some secrets.
like an Italian grandma, you gotta keep that recipe secret.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It's like, but it's funny because, you know, and everything's different. Like a particular character can be, it can be classical music from all different kinds of music, and whatever speaks to me for that character, I sort of put together as a thing. And what's great about it is then you're on set and when you just hear it, you're automatically back in character. It's funny because I passed that on in the rehearsal process for our film to a lot of the actors. And so on my set, it was funny because a lot of the actors had their earphones in and were doing, I was, oh my God, I've created this Frankenstein. but it's really a wonderful thing. And the funny thing is, to this day, when I hear any of the pieces that are Drusilla thing, I all of a sudden feel like, wait, I'm supposed to start talking about Drew. So I have to be careful if I'm in public and one of the music comes on that I don't, you know, start talking to anybody else in Drusilla speak.
Oh, okay. So listen, you have created a movie called A Place Among the Dead. And I would love to start with you at the beginning of that project, because there are so many layers to the project. And I just would love to know where this began, what was the moment when you knew you had to make this film, when you knew you wanted to make this film?
Well, I wanted to make a movie about the repercussions of growing up under the sway of narcissism and evil. And my husband, Dev, and I both come from this background, and we wanted to make a movie that we had never seen before and talk about something that we haven't seen in films before, and actually that isn't really talked about in society as a whole. I wanted to use genre to make an entertaining movie, but also to lull the audience into a sense of safety to explore unsafe ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because narcissism and evil are obviously abound in our society. Things seem to be escalating and escalating right now. The thing that's interesting is if you Google narcissism, there are 9,120,000 YouTube videos. There are 70,400,000 Google results. If you look at psychological abuse, there's 188 million Google results. So obviously people are searching for it, are wanting to talk about it, are needing to talk about it. And so that really was the inception of the process.
Did you know at the outset, because the film, and you know, I know that a lot of our listeners are going to watch it, so I won't spoil anything too deeply, but there is sort of like a format shift in the film. And did you know that you were going to do that from the jump, or was that part of the creation? Did that come to you during the making of it?
Yes, we actually knew all along. It's, you know, decided to sort of make the movie as a, it's completely scripted, entirely scripted. Even the interviews are scripted, which is cool that you guys do.
No, not at all. Not at
Very
all.
Effective.
We wanted to do a meld of fact, fiction, and the fantastical, and blur the lines of reality and use that to make the movie as experiential as possible.
Yeah, it's like very immersive, and like you said, like all of these interview segments that are sort of like cut in throughout the duration of the film, I totally thought, I 100% had no idea those were scripted, and it's so cool to be hearing from folks like Joss and Rice, like talk about a genre luminary. Gary Oldman, who of course played Dracula in the 1992 film adaptation. Amazing to see all of these. Oh, Charlene Harris, who created the books that True Blood ultimately was based on. I mean, you really got quite an incredible roundup.
Every person has a tie to the vampire genre, and they all play alter ego versions of themselves. And so, you know, in scripting them, we really captured the views of each person and worked with them on it when we were doing that.
So cool. So that process even was collaborative to a point.
Yes, absolutely. And what was interesting about the movie is, you know, it uses the first person and the third person. What I was saying sort of about it being experiential, and what you were talking about it being immersive, is, you know, I wanted the viewer to experience it, like be a lot of the time in my alter ego's perspective, in Jules' perspective, and to feel, you know, it was interesting. Dev and I talked about the fact that we'd never heard a voiceover in a movie that sounded remotely like the thoughts running through our minds. And you know, we really wanted to look at where those thoughts come from, and how so much of the messaging from when you're young becomes these voices that inform your choices going forward and can lead to very destructive choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought those, the voiceover, the sort of like stream of consciousness, repetitive, invasive thoughts, all of those sections were really, I mean, intense and like unlike, I think there's one other place where I've experienced something in the same like sort of general ballpark, which is an episode of BoJack Horseman called Stupid Piece of Shit, which is all, it's also based on like sort of like invasive, repetitive thoughts, and like this man who is like a depressed alcoholic talking himself through his own like negative cycle. BoJack is like an incredible show, and that episode is one of the best. It's like a beautiful piece of art. So to like see something really similar here was very cool, and also like very effective, because who among us doesn't have those thoughts like echoing in our heads from whoever said them, or eventually they just turn into your own voice like over time, you know?
Exactly. And that's the thing, and it becomes unrelenting. And it's interesting with that, because we did, you know, sneak peeks just before lockdown when we finished the movie, and the response was so beautiful and powerful from the entire audience every time. Not only stayed afterwards to talk about the movie, but they stayed for like 2 hours then sharing intensely personal stories. I mean, one of the things that is interesting when we were doing some research on this is it turns out that 80% of the thoughts in everybody's minds, even if you come from the most healthy upbringing ever, are negative. And that's a pretty interesting statistic.
Holy crap.
Yeah, how we all talk to ourselves. And then, you know, how, you know, and the whole point of the movie is, you know, we all come from varying degrees of things, but it's that you can keep going on that path and making destructive choices, which, you know, my alter ego seems to be doing in the movie. Or, you know, as an adult, you can make a different choice and you can make a different life for yourself. And that's really what, you know, what we're talking about with the film.
Yeah. You start the film, you know, we've now dipped our toes into things like upbringing, and you begin the film very pointedly with photos of yourself as a child and of your parents. And so I wonder if you want to talk about that specifically, the choice to use those images and how that folded into the film.
Yes. I mean, I chose to make the movie exceptionally personal. As they say, the more personal, the more universal. Mm. I really use the parents as a device because I want the viewer to do the same. I want the person watching to become a participant. And I want to give voice to what has affected many. And the whole purpose of the film, besides being an entertaining movie, is to open up a dialogue and to provoke conversation. You know, what I think is interesting is that the parents appear for 44 seconds in the entire 76-minute movie. But the metaphor of that is that they're a small part of one's life. Like, you spend some years during when you're being raised, right? And then you spend all these other years of the rest of your life succumbing to some of that, unless you make a decision and make some changes in sort of letting that operate you.
Yeah. That's incredibly powerful, also because 46 seconds, you know, I would have thought that they were more present in the film. So the immersive element of that was very effective as a viewer.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, and I did, it's funny that you're talking about, because I really wanted the movie, you know, that thing I don't know about with you guys, but, you know, what your thoughts are like. But, you know, when you're on a negative spin, it isn't relenting. Like, I didn't want to put music under it. I didn't want to put sound effects, because it's like there is nothing else when you're having those kind of negative thoughts. There is, you know, you're not hearing and seeing and in the world in its full proper glory. You're kind of in this one section of really your false self and this, you know, false identity and these negative things. And so so it was interesting because I played with different elements of that. And you guys would know, actually, in terms of the Harry Groener, who played the mayor in Buffy, he and his wife Dawn are the parents' voiceover in the movie.
You know, I saw Harry. I didn't see Dawn's name, but I saw Harry's name in the credits. So it was after I had watched it and was like, oh, holy shit. So incredible.
It was really great. And it was funny when we were recording that stuff because we recorded probably, I'd say maybe like 2.5 hours straight of these all different sort of thoughts that we had scripted. And afterwards, we all were sitting there for a minute and everybody was quiet and sort of very dark. And Harry was like, "Hey, booze." So we're like, "Yes, let's crack it open and let's have some positive talk right now."
Well, it's like,
oh, a precursor to 2020.
So
touching on like parent-child relationships, I think is going to be charged in one of any number of ways for just about everybody. Like, we all have either relationships to our parents or relationships to, you know, the idea of parentage and like what those relationships can be like and last, you know, how they may go on to affect you over the course of your entire life. On the mm-hmm. sort of like flip side of that coin, in terms of like important relationships, you worked on this film with your partner, Dev, and we were kind of wondering, you know, is this the first time you two have worked on a project like this together? What was that like? He also appears in the film. My guess would be that it would be like awesome to have your partner there for you guys to sort of like be leaning against each other at the same time over the course of making this.
It's not the first time. We did two short subjects. We did something called Take Flight, which was all about Gary Oldman's creative process. And then we did a short documentary called Dream Out Loud where we interviewed Guillermo del Toro and Rian Johnson, who directed Star Wars, The Last Jedi and Knives Out recently. And then also Gordon-Levitt was in that. I mean, we absolutely love collaborating together. We have very different strengths. Dev is a cinematographer and a stills photographer. And so he has a very strong visual background. And I'm, as a performer, have a very strong sort of acting and emotional background. And even in life, we sometimes make a joke and say we make one terrific person. it's pretty great. And also, you know, with this project, we were essentially almost on a mission. We wanted to have this creative venture. We wanted to make it really to open up a dialogue. And so, and it's interesting because the response that we've gotten in terms of what people are saying is that it's, you know, a genre bending art film, and that it, what you were saying sort of in terms of the immersive aspect of it. And so I think for both of us, it, you know, we compiled both of our experiences for some of the elements that are the factual elements in the film. And it's been a real journey in terms of everything that we've learned and the process together. And, you know, just in general, he's the best partner ever. And we both feel so fortunate to have discovered what love really is, and that love is having someone's back and them having yours, and what that really means when someone wants the best for you, was a discovery for us. And I think that's present in the film. And sometimes it almost seems miraculous in a non-religious sense that, you know, we were able, to have this kind of relationship, not having been shown it in any way. So it's great. I mean, it's just, you know, the workload has been insane. We basically don't have a house, you know, and while sleeping, we'll roll over and say, I have this idea, which I'm sure, you know, doesn't happen with other partnerships, because people restrain themselves from calling someone at, you know, 5 a.m. or 4 a.m. So it has all of that aspect, but it's, we really do bolster up each other's strengths in a, you know, exceptional way, I think.
It's so powerful to be able to, you know, not only have that support within a relationship, but then to be able to use that to create together.
You just made me think of this Greek myth. It's sort of a creation myth. It's about like how in the beginning, humans had two heads and four legs. And then the gods were like, this is too good. They've one human has it all, and we can't abide that. So the gods split all the people into two-legged, one-headed humans, thus kind of like cursing them to be forever seeking their soulmate in order to find like that perfect partner who makes them whole, which is just kind of what you made me think about while you're talking about Dev, which is very sweet. You make one really great person together, and we should all be so lucky.
We say that, and we actually sometimes wonder, like, is that not a good thing? Did it take two of us to make, you know? But even so, for instance, Dev is dyslexic, so he thinks very outside of the box, and I'm very sort of, or so we sort of pull it together, and it ends up working. But that myth is amazing. I've actually never heard that, and it's quite a moving myth.
Yeah.
tying together a bit of Buffy and this movie, this film, A Place Among the Dead. A lot of the film is set in Santa Barbara, and we have many listeners in Santa Barbara. The former mayor of Santa Barbara, who gave us a tour of the city and said, "This is Sunnydale. Santa Barbara is Sunnydale," right? And obviously, you know, in the series, we get a lot of B-roll of Santa Barbara. So I'm wondering if there was like a conscious connective tissue there, or if a lot of people just live in Santa Barbara.
No, you know what? They didn't live there. We set it there not because of that, but and not with its tie to Buffy, but it's an added bonus because in terms of the meld of the fact and the fiction and the fantastical, it's another layer of the sort of blurring of the lines and the crossover that actually is really interesting. That now I'll say, oh yes, that was totally
intentional.
That's just amazing.
Well, and there's another moment in the film. I mean, obviously, I think that the film is threaded through your previous work and characters and things in many ways. But there was one moment that came to mind when we were just talking where the mother of one of the victims says to you, like, how could you do that? How could you play like Juliet? How could you play these characters that bring like death and sort of like, you know, make this
glamorize
it? Exactly. And so I would love to hear you talk about that, like including that and what you think about that, because you are the Juliet who has played those characters.
It's an interesting thing. And it's something actually in terms of that I first thought about, and it's one of the reasons we included it in the film. And I thought about it when I was shooting Buffy. I remember a friend of mine saying, oh gosh, I really love the work that you're doing. And when I see Spike and Drew, they're so cool. Like, I really want to spend time with them. And I was like, well, you wouldn't because you're human, you know, like, but she said, like, we had a whole discussion about the nature of that and how, you know, what is that in terms of, are we, and then, you know, but the thing with also fantastical characters is certainly, you know, they're not real. Vampires are not real. Sorry, anyone who thinks they are. In my perspective.
Sorry to vampires and also.
Sorry to the vampires. Sorry to the vampires listening. You know, and so you are dealing with a fantasy world. And, you know, in our film, the character, there's a character that you're not sure if he indeed is a vampire or he's a serial killer. Either way, the same sort of traits apply. I mean, for me, the idea was the metaphor, you know, the vampire is the perfect metaphor for the ultimate narcissist, draining you completely for its. And so, you know, so we're not glamorizing it in the movie, but, and, you know, if you're playing often, you know, a villain or something, you're not glamorizing it. In terms of Buffy, you know, you are dealing with a fantasy universe. So it is something that isn't threatening in that way. It isn't encouraging, you know, real bad acts. One of the reasons Joss said he made the vampires have the vamp face when they were feeding and when Buffy, so that to be really clear that these are demons, you didn't want a high school girl going around and killing, even if it looked like humans, you know? And so he wanted to make it distinctive, like these are demons and she is doing, you know, she's fighting on the side of good and she's not doing something, you know, that is evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've had so many conversations, and I know as we begin season six, we're going to be having oh so many more about that, about the idolization of, you know, Spike, Drew, and Jealous, and, you know, Spike specifically as a character that we know, having talked to James, you know, it was like, why do you still like this guy? Like, what does he have to do to make you understand that, like, at the end of the day, he is a vampire?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, obviously, I'm still in that somewhat of that connection to Drew, because I'm like, yes, but that's why Drew and Spike have such more of a healthy relationship than Buffy and Spike. I'm still championing for that,
yeah,
right? Because
yeah.
Two demons being together is much better than a demon and a human.
I mean, I think you have a solid point, although I'm not sure where the metaphor will land us. But it makes sense to me on paper.
Right.
So a listener wrote in to us to ask about A Place Among the Undead, because the name of the film is A Place Among the Dead. And can you talk to us about the various projects that you're working on?
Yes, absolutely. So this, A Place Among the Dead, is our scripted feature film. And I know it's confusing because at one point we actually were calling our other project A Place Among the Undead, which was the least smart idea we've ever had. we thought like, oh, it's cool, there's an overlap. And it was like, no. So it has now evolved to become a series, and it's called The Undead Series. And it is a completely different project. It has a lot of the same talent came to work with us again, plus Tim Burton and Willem Dafoe. It's all documentary. It's all unscripted. And that is The Undead Series. And this is A Place Among the Dead, which is a scripted narrative film and stars myself and has Gary Oldman, Ron Perlman, Robert Patrick, Lance Henriksen, Joss Whedon, and Anne Rice appearing for the first time ever in a movie. And by the way, actually, we also have Kay Oldman, who is Gary's mom, appearing in a movie for the first time. She has always wanted to be an actress. She's amazing. Plays the nun. The nun in the movie.
She rocks.
The nun rocks.
Yes, she's phenomenal.
Yeah, the nun was like one of my favorite characters in the whole movie.
Yep. And so it was so cute because basically she sadly has passed away. This is actually her last sort of thing, and she got to do it on screen, and she was so amazing. And it was so cute because Gary lobbied for her to do the part, saying she's always wanted to be an actress. She was incredible. He drove her to set. He was running lines with her.
Oh my God.
Horrible. And she was so cute because I would say, and action. And she would go, are we going to have a go? And then I would say, yes, okay. Every time that I say action, we're going to have a go. And then I'd go, action. She'd go, no, I'd be like, yes, yes. Every time I say action, we're gonna have a go right then. Right. And action. So we're gonna have a go now. So it's very cute.
She was marvelous. Truly, she was so wonderful. That's incredible. You know, I think that there are so many things that we could talk about the film, but I'm wondering if there's anything that you want to talk about specifically that we haven't brought up, that we haven't asked, that you want people to know before they go into watching the film.
Well, I'm really excited about Modern Films, which is a female-based distribution company. And they are doing their first worldwide release with us. They usually are UK and Ireland. They have incredible taste in movies. They just released Werner Herzog's new film. Werner Herzog directed Rescue Dawn with Christian Bale, among many other brilliant movies. And they're releasing Viggo Mortensen's directorial debut. They are really excited about this movie. And we've crafted a release plan that is traditional, and we're doing all the traditional press and all of that stuff, but we're also doing these incredible events where we get to talk to people directly, which is what we want with this film. And so on October 29th, we have the worldwide virtual premiere. It's being sponsored by MAC Cosmetics and New York Comic Con, and the cast will be attending. And then on October 30th, we have Halloween Among the Dead, which is a virtual preview screening event. It's very Buffy-centric. It's Star Fury that we're doing it with, and it has a lot. So Harry Groner will be there as well as myself. On October 31st, Tomorrow's Ghost is having a preview screening event. It's very music and goth-centric, and it's an expansive Halloween-themed program. And then on October 30th, we have our premium video on demand run at U.S. Lemley theaters all across the U.S. and in practical theaters wherever is possible.
Right.
And then starting November 9th, the film will be hosted on the Modern Films website and in virtual theaters across the world. So starting October 29th, virtually everybody can come and see the movie. And I would love to give you the link for tickets if that works.
Yes, absolutely. We'll put the link in our show notes here and share it on social media as well so that everybody can find it and get to it, because I know that they're going to want to.
Perfect. So the website, it's modernfilms.com/A Place Among the Dead.
Great.
That that's where the tickets for all of the above are awesome. Available.
Oh, incredible. Incredible. Julia, before we end this wonderful conversation that we, of course, never want to end, we thought that with Halloween right around the corner, with you having a movie release right around the bend, that we would ask you if you have a favorite scary movie.
Ooh, I think I might have to go with some classics. I think The Shining. I think there's a movie called Don't Look Now that's with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie and is really, really scary. Again, kind of more psychologically scary. And then, you know, our movie has been likened to Donnie Darko, Eraserhead, Black Swan. Somebody said it's described as a David Lynch home movie or Black Swan with a message. And those are all incredible movies that I love as well. So it's hard to pick one, but those are some goodies.
Yes. Well, and I feel like the type of scary movie is very clear based on your choices. There's a lot of psychological thrilling happening. Yeah.
That's what I usually am drawn to. In terms of, you know, it's one of the things that's interesting with the genre that you can, again, like with Buffy, high school is a nightmare. You can talk about things in a way that isn't hitting people over the head, that isn't going so directly at something. And I think that that's a wonderful way to get to talk about things and use art and entertainment to talk about things.
Yeah. Ah, Juliet, thank you so much. Good luck with the next few weeks of prepping for all that is to come. And of course, if you're listening, we'll put all of the things you need to know in the show notes so that you can watch the film and follow Juliet and all that you do, because I know that this is one among many projects and I'm sure you have many more to come.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been so much fun hanging out with you guys today. I've just really enjoyed this conversation so, so much.
Thank you. Thank you for being here with us. And thank you for bringing us Drusilla and
yes, thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely. And look forward to our next
right on.
Chat.
Yes, same. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Drusilla, you fill my heart with dread. And still I'm led right back to you.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.